This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode in the news, the new airline startup Airbon, Boeing's fighter bid is rejected by Canada, more on 5G and aviation signal interference, people trying to bring the darndest things on airplanes, what happens when you drop an iPhone from an airplane, an Australian water landing that worked out okay, and in A350 news, peeling paint in a possible single-pilot freighter. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 681 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk Podcast, a national CFI of the year, and an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Max, it's that time of year. I've been listening to Christmas music. I've been buying stuff on Cyber Monday. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
Wow. I've been playing Grinch this holiday season. Yeah, it's sort of like, what's everybody got so, so much to be happy about? But it sounds terrible, doesn't it?
Okay, Scrooge, let's move on.
Yeah. Okay. So also with us is Rob Mark. He's contributing editor to Business and Commercial Aviation, which is part of the Aviation Week group. And he's also a publisher at jetwine.com.
Hey, good evening to all and to all. Good night. I had to say, I don't know what that has to do with anything. But now, being married to a shrink, Max, I can tell you that you're not the only one that feels grumpy this year. I think so many people assumed that the pandemic was going to be behind us at this point. And now with this new variant, they go, oh, my God, here we go all over again. Will this ever end? I think that's probably the answer. It never will.
But we get to hang out and talk with all our friends.
That's right. And that's why we're here.
Doesn't get much better than this.
Now, we have one friend that we're not speaking with tonight, and that's David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. David is actually moving. He's fleeing Pennsylvania and moving into Delaware. So Delaware's not very big, so it probably won't be too hard to find David.
Isn't that where our young Daniel was from?
Delaware?
Or was it Rhode Island or something?
I think it might have been Rhode Island. That was years ago.
Oh, that was, it's back when I was a child.
maybe not that long ago. All right, we've got some news for this episode. We've got some guests coming up in the next few episodes, but today we're going to be talking about some of the aviation news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
Ready from
Absolutely.
The West.
Absolutely.
First story comes from onemileatatime.com. This is Airbon, new SoCal-based U.S. airline startup. So Airbon, A-I-R-B-A-H-N. It was actually founded in February 2018 by the CEO of AirBlue. If you don't know AirBlue, that's the second largest airline in Pakistan. And just recently, the airline received what's called a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity for Interstate Air Transportation. Actually, they got that in October last year, 2020. From the DOT, but now they've taken delivery of their first A320 in the United States, which is kind of conveniently an ex-AirBlue plane, now has registration code N786PB. So here we go, another one. We've had a kind of a lot of startup airlines in the United States recently, it seems.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about the pandemic, but I think a lot of people decided now is the time to launch. So we keep hearing about new ones. This one has a kind of interesting model. It appears that they're going to be based out of the Ontario Airport in Southern California. Originally, it looked like they were going to be doing work out of Long Beach, but seems like the hiring they're doing is in Ontario, so they may have moved to a less expensive airport on the eastern edge of the LA metro area. They're also hiring in Oakland, Sacramento, and San Jose, which is just a few miles from here. So I'll be interested to see if I can get some good fares. But it looks like they're going to be running mostly up and down the coast of California to start, which kind of begs the question, wow, if you're just getting started, do you need an A320 to serve those markets? I would imagine it's going to be, you know, they're going to have to go for some pretty low fares initially, I would imagine, to attract people initially. The author here at One Mile at a Time said that he's skeptical about the viability of this business model being based in Ontario and running routes to all these different outliers on the hub. One thing about Ontario, I guess, you know, it's not really in the heart of, you know, where most of the people would be located. So it does have one other interesting aspect, which is that the pilots all get to come home at night. Mm-hmm. So all the flights return back to Ontario. So from a pilot standpoint, sounds pretty cool. It'll just be interesting to see how well they do.
Yeah, those A320s. Well, first, let me just say that there isn't a lot of information from Airbon on this is exactly what they're going to do. And most of what we do know comes from their filing. So that may change. We don't know. But what we understand is that their A320s will have 174 seats each. These are single class configuration aircraft. And as you say, return to base every day. They're hiring. If you go to the Airbon.com website, there's really not much more than nothing on the website at this point, other than a note that they are hiring and are looking to fill a number of positions. It's kind of a wide range. They're looking for pilots, captains, and first officers, but they're also looking for station supervisors, in-flight training instructors, as well as cabin crew, and some maintenance positions as well, some AMTs, lead aircraft maintenance technician, manager of maintenance control, some kind of a safety position. Those are at different locations. Many of them are at that Ontario airport location, but Irvine, California shows up, Sacramento, station supervisor at San Jose. In terms of pilots, let's see, this shows that as we record this, number of openings, 7 openings for captain, 9 openings for first officer. Cabin crew, only 3 openings at this point. So, you know, as they say on the webpage, let your career fly high with us. Dream, fly, discover. So if you're looking for employment with a new airline startup, hey, Airbon might be something of interest.
I wonder what they're going to be called on the radio. Airbon, no. Bond, no. Bun, no, they wouldn't want that. It sounds too much like buns. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. But you know what I do think is funny is that in years past, when new airlines sprouted up like this that seemed to come out of nowhere, they were always using old airplanes and what were considered old airplanes then. You know, old 737s, old MD-80s, that kind of thing. This is a, I think it said it's a 12-year-old A320, which is a fairly recent airplane. But of course, as Max said, is that what they need to get started? Of course, they're only going to have one. So if they have any kind of a mechanical during a duty day, they're done. Because there's no backup. So it'll be interesting to see how they make it work.
Yeah, competition's good. It's always nice to see someone else decide that creating an air carrier is a viable idea.
Hey, speaking of competition, I was thinking about who they're going to be up against. I think I know who they're going to be up against. Who do you guys think is going to be their biggest competition?
Southwest, probably.
Bingo, that's it. They serve, I believe, every single city that is mentioned here that Autobahn is going to be in. Tough competitor. I think that's going to be an interesting challenge to out Southwest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know really very much about the Pakistani airline, Air Blue. So I can't speak to the CEO of AirBlue, founder of AirBond. I can't speak to that individual's skills in running an airline. I don't know. If any of you listening have some thoughts on that, to be curious, you can send us an email, drop us a line, and help us understand sort of the track record of the folks who've created this new airline.
And just to follow up on one point, it says they're going to have two A320s, so it's not going to be just one.
Oh,
what they did say is that the first one has already been flown in, and I got a tweet a few days ago with the FlightAware track showing that it had indeed arrived on the West Coast.
Yeah. All right, we have a military story. Micah sent this in, and of course, anytime Micah sends in a military story, David is off. Doesn't it seem that way? Doesn't it seem like the last three or four times that's happened? That we've had a military story from Micah. David has found a reason not to come.
It does seem that way. Why do you suppose that is?
I don't know. Just
see, I thought it was me.
You thought you were driving him away?
Yeah.
So this comes from the Times columnist. Boeing told its bid to sell fighter jets to Canada did not meet Ottawa's requirements. So this is according to sources. This is the usual anonymous sources because no one's been authorized to discuss this publicly. So the part that these sources are talking about is Boeing's bid to replace the Canadian fleet of CF-18s with Super Hornets. And according to the sources, that bid has been rejected. Now, Canada's got some pretty old F-18s, CF-18s, and a number of companies have been circling and submitting bids for replacements. Lockheed Martin has a bid for the F-35 and Saab with the Gripen, and I think everyone else has dropped out. There was some sentiment that Canada was going to pick an American company. For lots of different reasons. And so I think a lot of the international competition fell out, thinking that it was not worth the effort. But Saab has stuck in there with the Gripen. So apparently the bids from Lockheed Martin for the F-35 and Saab for the Gripen have been accepted, but not Boeing's. Now, the requirements for the bid were that, the obvious that the aircraft submitted had to meet the missions that were described both at home and abroad. And also, though, for substantial Canadian economic benefit, which means that the bid had to include some economic value, some economic benefit. A lot of times that's co-production or something of that sort. We don't know where Boeing apparently fell short. But I guess those were the two candidates, the economic benefit and the mission requirements.
Well, I know that in the past I have seen where companies will write lockout specs into their RFPs. So if they're kind of biased toward, one company or another, they might find that one obscure spec that can be only met by one company or a few companies. I mean, that's certainly possible, though I don't know why, Canada would choose to do that against Boeing. But yeah, the whole idea of, Boeing perhaps not providing enough local content and enough Canadian produced parts going into it, to me seems like a pretty likely candidate.
Mm, it does. And another aspect of this that you never really know is, how much heart does a company have in winning the bid, winning the contract. And I don't know if Boeing just really, really, really wants this or something else. But it would seem that the F-35 has got kind of a good shot at this. Canada was one of the partner companies for developing the F-35, I think going all the way back to 1997. And according to this article, they've invested $613 million U.S. to remain a partner. Now, the benefits of being a partner is you list price maybe gets a bigger discount, and if there's co-production going on, or maintenance collaboration going on, then if you're a partner, that can mean revenue in the future for purchases to others. So with all that going on, you know, the F-35 seems to be a pretty strong candidate. I mean, the Gripen is, all right, so that's a nice airplane, but most of Canada's allies fly the F-35, so that commonality would seem to be an advantage to that aircraft.
Well, the F-35 is pretty long in the tooth, is it not? I'm sorry, not the F-35. The F-18 is pretty long in the tooth, no matter what version it is.
Well, the Super Hornet's less so, but you know how they compare to the F-35. I don't know. I think they have different strengths. That's something David could talk to better than I could. But yeah, I think they kind of have different strengths.
Well, here's the big question that we haven't really talked about. I mean, who does Canada need to defend themselves against? I mean, they got to get invaded by Alaska or Greenland. Who are they defending themselves against?
Well, but they're part of NORAD, aren't they?
Right.
I mean, to help defend the entire North American region?
Yeah. Maybe they defend the United States.
I think you mean NATO, not NORAD.
No, I think I meant NORAD because... Okay. NORAD does the U.S., and I think they had – maybe I've got that wrong. Maybe
actually, you know what? I just looked it up. It looks like you're right. I was thinking NORAD was just U.S.-based, but it does say Canadian American Defense Command, known as NORAD. So you're right.
Cool. Yay! I got one right, guys! Hot dog on a military topic. Wow, that never happens.
No. How many
hundred episodes? Well, probably the last time it's going to happen.
Actually, maybe they're worried about Maine invading them. That's probably what
it is. There you go, because they heard about Micah.
And, exactly.
It's just time to fess up.
All right, we have a follow up. We've been talking about 5G how that may or may not interfere with aircraft systems, and I think on the first go round of this, where we talked about it anyway. We mentioned that the FAA has some concerns. The FCC and the industry didn't really have concerns. And it was a question of, okay, how's this going to get hashed out? You've got these two government agencies with different objectives viewing the same thing differently. And then we saw more recently that the carriers decided to defer implementation of 5G by 1 month from early in December, I can't remember which date it was, to early in January. But now we have some more information. This one comes from 9to5Mac, and it's titled 5G Aviation Fears, Mobile Carriers Propose to Reduce Power, Especially Near Airports. So what the carriers are proposing is to temporarily reducing the power, the base station power everywhere. And then in addition, I guess, limiting the power near airports and heliports and doing this for a period of 6 months. So that's kind of a big step back for the mobile carriers.
I think especially because to the outside world, there's no evidence that the 5G phone spectrum is a problem for anybody. You know, the FCC passed on it, so the FCC is at least as smart as FAA people think, right? And they said, we don't see any issue. But of course, and this does seem like if it's potentially a radio altimeter issue, it is a pretty narrow band of concern. But then they say, well, they've been using them in Europe and there haven't been any problems. So again, that's a good point. And I haven't heard anything out of FAA since that.
Well, I think FAA is right to tread slowly. Yeah, I think the big difference is the FCC is interested in promoting commerce and telecommunications, whereas the FAA is all about safety. So there are, I think there could be reasonable disagreements when you kind of look at the use of the spectrum from those two different perspectives. One of the comments was that the industry, AT&T and Verizon, may have used this kind of as a tactic to prevent more harsh regulations that might have occurred. So, you know, by giving in a little bit, maybe this hopefully allows them from, you know, being prevented from using the spectrum. Another comment here was that the FCC approved the use of the C-band after analyzing the interference claims, but didn't find any evidence to support the claims. And I think the problem is, yeah, just because you didn't find evidence doesn't mean it doesn't necessarily exist. So I think they're looking to perhaps run a trial here just to see, hey, can we find if there is some hidden problem? And certainly, I think running lower power levels is a good way to start and to help avoid the most severe problems that they might find.
In 6 months, sounds like.
Did you read any of the comments that were following this?
No, this time I didn't. What'd you find?
Well, it was interesting. One fellow said, okay, maybe we could go along with this so long as we set a precedent right now to limit the damages that anybody can receive if there's an accident. And I thought, okay, that's one way to look at it. And what Max said earlier is true. FAA is thinking about safety, and the FCC is back kind of in the old days where FAA used to promote aviation, and then they stopped doing that. Maybe there was a point to that.
Hmm. All right, we've got a couple of fun stories. You know, we had, sometimes we just talk about stuff that's it's just so serious, you know. And so there's a few fun things in the news these days. One is from the Points Guy. This is four things TSA really doesn't want you to bring on an airplane.
Let me guess. Snakes. Didn't they do a movie about that?
Yeah, they did. Huh? They did. The first one they mentioned is guns. And I did a search. What did I look at? Oh, I looked at I went to the TSA website and looked at their news items and just scrolled down through them. And, you know, it feels like almost half of them, easily half of them, were about guns being found at TSA checkpoints, people trying to or forgetting they had or I don't know what, but people whose carry-on luggage had guns or ammunition. So guns is the first one. And, of course, the rule is no guns, no ammunition in your carry-on. Now, generally you can put a carry a gun in your checked baggage, but it has to be in a hard-sided container and locked, and you have to declare it to the airline. Yeah, it's amazing how many people – I mean, everybody knows you're not supposed to bring a gun on an airplane, right?
Well, the funny thing was I think we read that the number of gun discoveries actually increased during the pandemic, while the number of air passengers had decreased, which, you know, either the TSA was getting better at finding the guns yeah. or more people were carrying them during the pandemic, which I find fascinating.
Oh, not near as fascinating as the people that say, I had a loaded 38 in my carry-on. I completely forgot. Oh, God, really?
Yeah.
It could happen, I suppose. But yeah, for those of us who don't carry on a daily basis, it does seem hard to imagine.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you do carry it, you really, and I think most people really do know where their gun is. To do otherwise is not, that's not responsible gun ownership. But before we tick off, and I am a gun owner, by the way, just so, you know, people don't think that I'm anti-gun or anything, but I am anti-gun on an airplane.
Yeah, definitely. Rob, make a note here. Don't tick off Max, okay?
Yeah. Or if you do, make sure you're on an airplane. All right. Next one is hygiene products, full-size hygiene products. People, the requirement is a maximum of 100 milliliters, which is a little over 3 ounces. Shampoo, whatever stuff you have in liquid form to keep yourself nice and sparkly, clean and fresh. But people still bring full size bottles of this stuff. But 100 milliliters. But what a lot of people don't realize is, you know, you can't just load up your carry-on with dozens and dozens of little bottles of whatever it is you wish you had a big bottle of. That these 100 milliliter bottles have to fit in a single one-quart resealable bag. So that, you know, there's that limitation on how much of this stuff you can actually bring with you.
Except, you know, it's funny because if you look at the TSA pre-check program, I have carried things on the airplane going through pre-check, you know, because it speeds you through. I haven't had anybody pull a plastic bag out of my bag in years.
But, of course, you're being fully compliant regardless, right, Rob?
Oh, yes, of course, yes. I just meant for those people that would be disreputable enough to try to sneak in an extra bottle of, you know, shampoo or something.
Conditioner. I'm just happy these curls are natural, so I don't have to bring anything with me.
I just wish I had a need for shampoo.
Okay.
Alcohol.
I think that's what we were talking about when you came in, Max.
It was.
There's something we could all use.
Alcohol. So, yeah, we've seen some alcohol inspired arguments, let's say, or fueled arguments increasingly. So let's talk about checked bags. According to the rule, you can bring up to 5 liters in checked bags per passenger. That's about 1.3 gallons. And this applies to alcohol that's at least 24%, well, to a beverage that's at least 24% alcohol, but not more than 70% alcohol. 70% alcohol, that's 140
that's
proof.
That's pretty intense.
Yeah.
That's dangerous.
That's dangerous. So
don't light that stuff.
No, no. Now, as far as carry-on goes, you can bring miniature bottles of alcohol. But here again, the quart-sized bag, they have to comfortably fit into a single quart-sized bag. So that limits the number of the little miniature bottles. But, and we've seen somebody run afoul of this, while you can bring this limited quantity of alcohol with you on board, you cannot consume it on board. All alcohol has to be served by the flight attendants. And there was one of the recent fines for unruly passenger behavior that I recall seeing was for just this exactly. A passenger brought his own alcohol on board and was drinking it and then got involved in some bad behavior. So that's the third one, alcohol.
What else could they not possibly want on the airplane?
This is really funny. Fertilizer. So I guess fertilizer can be flammable. That's what the issue is. But you're not allowed to bring it on carry-on or in checked luggage. So I guess leave your Miracle-Gro home. But you are allowed to bring plants.
I suppose they have to be in water. Hydroponic plants only. No, no soil or fertilizer.
There's no single quart-sized bag rule for plants, but they have to fit in the overhead bin or underneath your seat. So plants, yes. Fertilizer, no. Okay, another item. This is, but we had, where did all the Mac stuff come from? We had 9to5 Mac. So this is from Apple Insider. iPhone survives landing after pilot takes airplane mode way too seriously.
I didn't know that iPhones could fly. They can also land, apparently.
They can, at least in Florida. This was an Orlando pilot. Now, he was flying a Seminole, as I understand it, a twin engine.
Twin engine trainer, yeah. So it's among the smaller of the twins that are out there.
So how do you drop your iPhone off of a Seminole during takeoff?
Very easily.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Let's see if your idea is the same as mine.
I'm betting we do. So when you're boarding the airplane, sometimes people will rest stuff on the wing, or they might rest stuff on top of the cabin, and then they climb in and they forget to bring that stuff in with them. Gosh knows, this has never happened to me, well, more than once. It wasn't a phone, but I did leave a control lock one time on my seaplane, which went flying off the wing and onto the tarmac as we were taking off.
Wow. But at least it wasn't still engaged.
Yeah, that's true. I had removed it. I just hadn't stowed it properly. Was that your guest suit too, Rob?
No, actually, I was thinking that maybe while they were doing the pre-flight, the pilot might have taken a picture of something and said, oh, I've got to get that looked at when I get back on the ground, and got distracted and maybe left the phone on the wing somehow and just completely walked away from it.
Right.
Even though it's a little hard to believe because the Seminole is a low-wing airplane, but could happen.
Yeah, okay.
Actually, there's
nobody looks out at the wing.
One other possibility. A lot of Pipers have that little side window. I'm guessing the Seminole has one as well, too. And if you want a nice, clear video, you would stick your phone out the window to record that takeoff. And, of course, you get about 80 miles of wind blowing against that. Pretty easy to pull it out of your hand.
Well, he was lucky in that iPhones have an app. It's Find My iPhone. And basically, you can use it along with its GPS capabilities to find the coordinates of your phone should you lose it. And this pilot had it set up, and he contacted air traffic control to let them know that there was a phone on the runway. And the exchange is pretty amusing. We can play a little bit of the ATC conversation that ensued.
I'm sorry, this is Tower. Ops 2, Tower.
I'm holding short at Alpha 8, holding short runway 7. I've got a pilot with me from Seminole who says he dropped his iPhone on the runway.
Okay, where at on the runway?
Think about, he looked on his satellite and said it's about 1,000 feet down, just to the right of the center line. We're going to try to find it.
Okay, hold short. I got traffic serious there on a mile and a half. Proceed on runway 7.
Ops 2, proceeding on runway 7.
Cherokee's doing a low approach above 500.
And we found it.
All right. Be a good story for Apple if he turns it on and it works.
It's working.
All right, sir. Exit 1 able, Ops 2, and advise clear.
And exec ground, Ops 2.
Ops 2, ground.
Go back to golf.
Ops 2, roger. Back to the West Ramp via golf.
Ops 2, heading back to heli team ramp via golf.
How shattered the screen?
No, it's perfect shape and it works.
No way.
And his satellite thing had exactly where it was.
That thing's got to be wrapped in like a concrete block or something.
It's working fine.
No way an iPhone fell off a plane going 50, 60 miles an hour and didn't break the screen.
Well, we got a new endorsement here.
I still don't believe you.
I mean, I'm not actually trying to call you a liar, but I've never seen an iPhone fall more than 4 feet, not break in half.
Isn't that the truth?
Right?
All right. I'm not trying to call you a liar.
But you're lying.
If the shoe fits.
But I am doing it publicly for all to hear.
See, and I think, Max, either one of our cases, I think it makes sense that it was out on the wing somewhere.
Yeah.
And when they poured the coals to it for takeoff, 1,000 feet down the runway, that's just maybe the time they got to be 60, 70 miles an hour or whatever, and it blew off. So they didn't need the insurance after all. It's great.
It's funny. And it's nice to hear funny stories sometimes.
I can see you talking to the insurance agent. So it fell off the wing of an airplane?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But we found it.
And how did it get there?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Okay. Sure. Yeah, right.
All right. So another story. This is from Reuters. You know, we
We have a string of, I don't know how many years, where there's been lots of stories to talk about Boeing-related issues, problems, whatever. And I don't know, maybe in Europe there's more Airbus stories, but they don't just don't make it here. I don't know. But here is one that's about Airbus. It's from Reuters. Costly Airbus paint flaw goes wider than the Gulf. And apparently airlines, some airlines are discovering that A350 paint is blistering and peeling off and exposing the composite material underneath. The biggest action that we see on this so far is in Qatar, where the Qatar Civil Aviation Authority has ordered the grounding of 20 of the airline's 53 A350s. Now, it's apparently not a safety issue. Airbus says it's not a safety issue, but the airlines kind of want to know what's happening to the paint on their A350s.
It just doesn't seem fair to me. I mean, you pay $140 million for an airplane, and then you get picky about the paint? I mean, really? No, I'm teasing. Yeah. I mean, if I'd paid that much for an airplane, I'd darn well be upset if the paint was coming
off. If you look at the pictures, I mean, these don't look like little paint blobs. I mean, these look like some serious paint issues, especially where the electrical wiring harness, or whatever they said for electrostatic harness, I guess it is, under the paint, because they've got to have something to conduct electricity for the lightning strike protection. I mean, it looks like a serious damage problem there. And to say that, oh, well, don't worry about it, it's not an airworthiness issue. Oh, yeah, okay. I couldn't tell where those were, but if a passenger saw that, somebody like one of us people who are snoopy and consider ourselves to be prime candidate know-it-alls, we'd say, how do you know that's safe? Yeah. I could put my finger through there. But then, as they said, Qatar's also perhaps trying to get out from under an order for more A350s because they perhaps have a sweeter deal for freighters from Boeing. I'm sure that's not it, but there's no story that it has one side. It's always interesting when you hear, oh, yeah, but.
Yeah. And Qatar, of course, is pretty extensive history of negotiating. I don't know if I want to say negotiating in the press, but they like to negotiate. But it's not just them. You know, when I first heard or read this, my first thought was, well, maybe it's hot environments or something that is causing this problem. But that's not the case, because Finnair has had paint issues. Now, I don't know if it's exactly the same problem, but reportedly as early as 2016, Finnair has had issues with some of the paint, looking at damage that it spread below that anti-lightning mesh that I think that you were talking about, Rob. But others have as well. So I don't think we really know what the cause of this paint problem is. I don't know if Airbus is, or if it's still investigating it. But I can certainly see the position of the airlines in wanting to, first of all, know what's going on and be positive that there is no safety issue.
Yeah, it seemed like that, don't worry, it's safe, might have been, I don't know, I mean, it could have been a little premature. Remember when Boeing was saying, oh, that, what was that crazy thing called on the 737? It's not a problem. Pilots can cope with it. Don't worry about it. Don't look over there. It happens. Of course, the Finnair thing, I think that makes perfect sense. I mean, it's cold up there. So, and, you know, of course, the air is just so thin that it's, you know, stuff happens in thin air, you know. Okay.
Okay.
Anyway. Yeah. Simpleflying.com, by the way, has a follow-up to this in which they mentioned five other airlines, including Finnair, that have had peeling paint problems. They also point out that Lufthansa has had paint missing as big as a square meter. So, like, 3x3, you know, foot area of paint missing. That's not just a little tiny crack in the paint. And it says that it appeared that Airbus was carrying out the repaint work for free as part of the warranty, which doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I would hope so. I mean, I can't imagine what it costs to repaint an air. It'd be interesting to know how many square feet of area need to be covered on the outside of an A350, because you've got, of course, the fuselage and the empennage and the wings and beneath them, and it's quite a bit of paint. You're not going to fix that with a spray can.
No, it is quite a bit of paint. I've read in the past, and I just don't recall how many pounds of paint is typically, it depends on the paint scheme and all, but the weight of the paint is not insignificant. I should look that up. That's probably an interesting number. What's up with the geeks? Max Trescott, doing any flying?
I'm headed eastbound this week, not too far from where Rob's going to be. That's a second trip. It looks like I may have two trips in December. Headed out later this week to Knoxville to pick up a brand new Vision Jet and bring it back to the West Coast.
Oh.
And so I'll then be doing some flying around with this gentleman to get him ready for his type rating, which will be in January, and then we'll probably fly the airplane back to Knoxville, so you'll have it there when he gets done with his type rating. So that should be great fun. Also, maybe going to Indy to pick up an SR-22 that a client of mine locally here has purchased. So that should be another fun trip back across the country, provided we have decent weather. Obviously, these trips aren't as much fun when you're dodging nasty weather. And I did, it's funny, I don't usually indulge in Black Friday purchases. I almost never do. But this year I thought, you know what? I really do want to get a GoPro camera. So I got that on order because I'd particularly like to film some of the Vision Jet trip coming back from Knoxville. So looking forward to doing that. That should be fun.
Hmm.
So you're doing Knoxville back to the Bay Area and then back again?
Yes, that's right.
Hmm. So what's flying in December? Any weather considerations that are sort of unique to the beginning stages of winter?
Well, the biggest consideration is what I'm packing and bringing with me. In fact, I was looking at Knoxville weather a day or so ago, just to kind of figure out, gee, do I need heavy boots and heavy gloves and things like that? That's frankly the biggest consideration.
Good. Will you be able to spend some time in Knoxville?
Most of these trips, come in one night and head out, fairly early the next day. I wish I had extra time to hang out, but that rarely happens. And it's impossible to get there from the West Coast before, 5, 6 o'clock in the evening. And invariably, I end up getting in at 11 o'clock. And things are delayed. I get in at 1 a.m. So it's just tough. We don't have any direct flights. There are always connections. And often there are delays. So that's the tough part. Coming back in the Vision Jet, that's usually actually a lot more fun than flying commercially to get there.
Yeah, I think so.
So how much time do you think that the owner will have in the airplane by the time he goes back to Knoxville to take his type ride?
I'd have to guess. I don't know how many days we're going to spend training together, but I would guess he's going to have at least 25 hours, which will certainly give him a good leg up on the training.
Mm-hmm. So the plane's coming from Knoxville, correct?
Yep.
And so you're going to fly it to California for training. Then you're going to go back to Knoxville? Why do you have to go back to Knoxville?
Well, so he could just fly back commercially, do his type rating, and fly home commercially. But he'd kind of like to have his airplane available there when he gets done with his type rating.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's right, because he probably could fly it home, right?
Certainly.
Well, he'd have to bring you home anyway.
Well, I'm not going to stick around for the 2 weeks of training that he's going to go through.
Right, yes.
Yeah. But I may be there to fly back with him, because typically after a Cirrus Vision Jet type rating or any type rating that occurs under Part 142 where the check ride is done in the simulator, the FAA requires 25 hours of time in the airplane, which is known as SOE or supervised operating experience, before the pilot can fly the airplane solo. So he'll need an additional 25 hours after the check ride before he can fly it by himself. And some insurance companies may have higher requirements as well for really low time pilots and may say, well, we want, you know, more than those, that number of hours.
How low time is he?
You know, he's been a pilot for a few years. I don't know how many.
All right. We had a request from one of our listeners to do a holiday Zoom call, which that sounds like fun. And we've done that in the past. Maybe it was a year ago, actually. And we just did one, and the problem with that was time zones. We kind of need to do two, and probably over a weekend, maybe like on a Saturday or something, when people would be or more people would probably be able to participate because they wouldn't be at work in whatever time zone they were in. So I might set that up. First, I have to see if I still have Zoom, if my subscription or whatever is still active. But maybe we'll do that like a week before Christmas, possibly on the weekend. So if any of you are interested in that, send us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And that way we'll know kind of who's interested, and we can email you with the specifics. I mean, we'll announce it in our Slack team and otherwise, but if we have your email address, we could be sure that you get the word. So let us know that if you're interested, or let us know that you're interested, and let us know when would be a really convenient time for you. And probably everybody's convenient time isn't going to line up, but at least give us some ideas for planning purposes.
Well, and since it's the holidays, I think we should also ask people to let us know whether they've been naughty or nice. And then we could have two separate Zoom calls, one for the naughty listeners and one for the nice listeners.
That is very clever. Yes.
Rob, you can host the naughty.
I obviously could help with the naughty one.
Clearly.
And that's going to be the more fun phone call, Zoom call. So we'll definitely be on that one for sure.
Yeah, good. All right. Anything going on with you, Rob?
I must say it's been relatively quiet here in Chicago. Just a lot of typical junk, but boy, I haven't done any flying in ages. We kind of ran out of airplanes to fly at Palwaukee, and I'm looking for someone that has a nice airplane that I might be able to use occasionally that's based at Papa Whiskey Kilo, which is just north of O'Hare. But I'm just saying, you know.
You had a plane accident there recently, right?
Yes, a 172 kind of lost control of the airplane on a crosswind. And I think it was a student. I believe it was a student, but took off when the wind was relatively low velocity out of the southwest, took off on a south runway, and by the time he or she came back, the wind had picked up considerably, gusting to about 25 knots with about 90 degrees to the runway. And for a student, that's quite a load. Listen, for a newly licensed private pilot, that's quite a load. And it got away from him.
And that exceeds the demonstrated crosswind for a 172, which, as I recall, is around 15 knots. So, yeah, that's a lot.
All right. We have some, we have one shout out and some listener mail. The shout out came from Micah. This is U.S. airmen shot down over Romania in World War II is accounted for. And this is the story of U.S. Army Air Force's Staff Sergeant Charles G. McMacken. He was 26. He was a bombardier on the B-24, a Liberator, and this was in Operation Tidal Wave in 1943. It was a big bombing mission in Romania against some oil fields and refineries. So his plane took some enemy aircraft fire. Plane crashed. His remains were not identified, and the remains of American personnel that couldn't be identified were buried in a cemetery in Romania, later moved to a cemetery in Belgium. But this gentleman remained unidentified. But he was exhumed in 2017, went off to off at Air Force Base in Nebraska for examination. And they were ultimately able to identify him using dental and anthropological analysis. But they also used mitochondrial DNA analysis, and they figured out that this was the staff sergeant. So his remains were finally accounted for. It's kind of, World War II was a long time ago, and families that have moved on but don't know what happened. It's kind of nice when something like this does occur, the serviceman was identified.
Well, this particular mission, it was kind of unique, and a lot of the bombing came out of Europe, but in this case, they flew up from Libya. It was a 2,000-mile mission. 178 heavy bombers participated, which was the largest number of American planes that had been involved in a bombing mission to that date. Only, I think, around 80, 88, something like that. Yep, 88 made it back to Libya. A lot of problems with that particular mission, including this one was amazing. One aircraft was flying very, very low, something like 50 feet over the refinery. It was leaking fuel, and it caught fire from the flames below. I have never heard of an airplane catching fire from an ignition source on the ground while the airplane was in flight. So pretty remarkable.
Yeah. They lost, as Max said, they lost a lot of airplanes. But and some of the bombing rates, he mentions 50 feet. Think about that. When you're flying in the traffic pattern, most of the bombing was done essentially below traffic pattern altitude for where we fly, with lots of people shooting at you from the ground. And not to mention all these oil tankers on the ground that were exploding when they were hit. So talk about scary. I get scared just listening to this. I can't imagine what those guys went through.
I know. And so young, too. So young. Yeah. Just incredible. We got an email from Rich. He sent along an article. This is live from alounge.com. It's titled, "The Airbus CEO Suggests A350 Freighter is a Good Candidate to Implement Single-Pilot Operations." Now, Airbus has a project. Internally, it's called Project Connect. And Airbus has indicated that one option with the A350F, the freighter, is to introduce a, quote, reduced crew on long-haul flights where you'd have just a single pilot in the cockpit most of the time, another pilot, but not in the cockpit. And that this might be a way to, or an opportunity to start to introduce single pilot operations. That's kind of an interesting thought.
No, it's not. I can't imagine. I talked to one of my buddies that flies for one of the freight carriers, and they still think they get pretty short shift in some of the regulations as they did when the duty, the rest period regulation came out about 10 years ago. And he said, you know, believe it or not, even though we're flying boxes, we get just as tired as the other guys do when they're flying a 14-hour mission. And I don't know why we're any different. So, like I said, it's a good point. And wait until something happens that one pilot's unable to cope with. But then I guess they figure, well, it's just a couple of pilots and a bunch of boxes.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch. I've got really strongly mixed feelings about this. I love technology. I think the technology probably can make this work. But I also know that, you know, on the bleeding edge of technology, you know, things sometimes fail. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in time we have single pilot freighters. And it wouldn't surprise me if we lose one at some point in time either. But if you look at the history, we've gone from four people in all of the cockpits down to three people, down to two people. And it seems like the economic forces are really pushing heavily to continue to get down to one pilot. I mean, heck, in the VTOL aircraft, the eVTOLs, they're talking about autonomous no pilots. So, yep, strong economic forces pushing us in that direction.
Now, I think it's worth mentioning, too, that not to misunderstand what Airbus is doing here. This is not a decision that's been made, but it just is an indication of how they're thinking about this inside the company, that these long-haul freighters might be an opportunity to explore single-pilot operations, but no decision has been made. They have not decided.
Well, and we should clarify too that doesn't mean there would only be one pilot aboard.
Right.
There would only be one pilot in the cockpit at any given moment, and the other pilot would be taking a break. But of course, the breaks can't be too long because you don't want to leave anyone up there for too long behind the controls, and then as soon as their break is over, they're right back in the cockpit. And I'd like to see how that's going to work on a night when they're just flying through unbelievable convective weather or something like that, and that first guy gets out of the left seat and goes, "Man, I need a break," and then he's right back in there an hour or something later. But again, we'll see.
Yeah.
And I said four pilots in the cockpit. I meant four crew members.
Right, right.
Because it used to be two pilots, navigator, and the radio operator, or engineer, depending upon the configuration. The first 707 I was ever on had a separate radio operator, as I recall, which was a Lufthansa transatlantic flight.
Yeah, presumably the single pilot in the cockpit could call up the other pilot if the situation indicated that was the right thing to do. But, as we were saying, if there is only one other pilot and is in a rest period and has come off of his stint in the cockpit, he or she may not be as refreshed and alert and able to contribute to resolving a tricky situation as would be the case if there's a fresh crew member, a fresh pilot available.
Well, you also got to consider that all these pilots that are doing long haul have issues, I think, with their circadian rhythms. It's just really tough to be flying across eight different time zones week in and week out and feel like you're able to get proper rest as well. So a lot of
And that's why you don't see them trying this or even suggesting this on transatlantic or trans-Pacific commercial flights with passengers on board, because I know they would realize the airline pilots unions would never go along with it. I mean, they'll probably never go along with it anyway, but I think that would be even less likely to happen, which is probably why they started here.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, we've often talked in the past how passengers will forgive almost anything for a cheaper price. I mean, this is a weird thought, but do you think we could ever get to the point where, you can have the flight with two pilots, or for $100 less, you can have the flight with one pilot?
Yeah, what's your risk tolerance and how much are you trying to save?
But we'll give you free Ambien, and it'll knock you out as soon as you're airborne, and you won't wake up until after we land.
There we go.
Probably.
All right, we heard from Errol in Perth. He said we saw this bloke running up prior to takeoff, then found out he went in the drink off one of the Perth beaches. Both in the plane got out safely. Two men escape serious injury after a light plane crashes into ocean off Perth. And it's from abc.net.au. I guess this was a Socata TB20, reportedly with engine troubles that went into the drink.
Yeah, the reporting was a little sloppy on this one. In the story, they mentioned it was a twin-engine airplane, and of course it wasn't. They mentioned something about him switching. Oh, right, in fact, it's near. He switched engines, which is kind of interesting if you only have one motor.
Yeah, I think that.
Yeah, usually it takes several mechanics and a few days to switch an engine in these aircraft.
Yeah.
You take one out and you put the other one in.
Yeah. Like in Observer, the woman said it bunny hopped across the water, but the force of the water really stopped it, which of course is what you would expect. But I guess there was no other option. The beach site, I guess, was completely unsuitable for landing, so looked like the only option was to ditch it in shallow water, I guess. But both occupants of the plane were, I don't know if they were unhurt, but they survived in any event.
Well, that's the nice thing about ditching close to the coast. The survival rate is extremely high for ditching in the water, either in inland lakes or in the ocean right next to the coast. It's only when you're hundreds of miles away or a long ways away from the coast that the fatality rate tends to go up. But yeah, ditchings, especially close to land, are very, very survivable.
Unless it's at night.
Ouch. Well, that would not be fun.
Yeah.
Well, and Rob, your friend Amy and I, a friend of ours, Amy, had a ditching in Florida in her 210. And it was rather amazing story hearing about what that was like and the water pouring in and how quickly that plane went down afterwards.
Yeah, Amy Labota. Yeah, I mentioned this before. I think, well, it's been years, but yeah, there was a great episode of Uncontrolled Airspace where she described that experience. And it was just a phenomenal description. I mean, it was somebody go out and look for the episode number, and I'll put it in the show notes because it's really worth listening to.
She may have written an article about it in Flying Magazine as well long ago, because I remember hearing more about it, and I know I didn't listen to that episode.
All right. Well, we want to thank all of you for listening to this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. A little bit of a short episode. Last week was a little bit of a long episode, so I guess we kind of average out. But thanks for listening. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes with links to all the stuff that we talked about at airplanegeeks.com/681. And as we mentioned, you can always write to us. You can send us an email, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, Max Trescott, tell us where we can find you. And
the usual places. Come on over to aviationnewstalk.com, and I will mention that episode 210, which is out, is about controlled flight into terrain. Unfortunately, a gentleman I know had just such an accident a couple of months ago that was fatal. So we'll be talking about that. And of course, if you want to contact me, just click on the top of the page at aviationnewstalk.com on the contact sheet, and you can send a note to me.
Cool. And Rob Mark, how about you?
Jetwine.com, of course, here and in various magazines like Business and Commercial Aviation. And I was just grimacing as Max was telling me about that that next episode. I want to hear it, but I don't want to hear it. That's the way those stories go. And we just seem to not be able to find any new ways to break airplanes. We just keep using the same half a dozen methods that have been going on for, you know, for the dawn, since the dawn of time, aviation wise.
Yeah, true. And you can find me at 30,000feet.com, all words, spell it out. And we'll ask that you please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Nighty night. Oh, and as David would say,
thanks for listening.